Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Roger Luckhurst. He's a professor of 19th century studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. And we're talking about his most recent book, Graveyards, A History of Living with the Dead. Roger, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, well, it's great to get the invitation. I'm always very happy to talk about graves.
You must have done an enormous amount of research for this book, because this book covers so much history, so many cultures around the world. Is this a book you've been building up to over the years?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm someone who's worked on the Gothic for a long time.
Oh, I know that.
So
yeah.
I kind of knew the backstory of kind of graveyards and the kind of quite grim, actually, 19th century story about the overflowing graveyards. But when I was asked by the publishers to do this, we were very kind of clear we wanted to go across the globe and to try and go across time. I wasn't quite expecting to go back as early as I needed to. So we go back to prehistory, 3 million years ago, and then all the way up to the present. And it was always something that I wanted to do almost for myself, because I was, you know, sometimes you're slightly uncomfortable if you're in another culture and you don't quite sure how to behave if you come across a graveyard. Do you cover your head? Do you take your hat off in respect? You know, I just didn't know all these things. So it was a great opportunity to kind of teach myself really that. And it was incredibly eye-opening to do that.
Well, you're very careful in the book to talk about respect for other cultures.
Sure.
And that comes up several times throughout the book.
Yeah.
At the same point, you mentioned something that I had never heard of before, and that's dark tourism. What is that?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a term that I guess academics started to use in the 1990s. And it's really this growing kind of trend for people to, I don't know, it starts by looking for haunted houses or Halloween kind of festivals, you know, festivals for the dead, all those sorts of things. But increasingly, of course, we're building in Holocaust tourism,
right.
Tours back to battlegrounds. People are very interested in the Civil War, say, or in South Africa, there's a big culture of going to the Boer War battlegrounds. So all of that is called dark tourism. And really, it's a sort of queasy term which is meant to both acknowledge that that's a really big industry now, but also, you know, is it always coming from a good place? Do
yeah,
we need
yeah.
to examine what it is that we are, you know, being interested by? I mean, some cultures warn you against hanging out with the dead too much. You know, the term ghoul comes from the North African spirit that hangs around in graveyards that attaches itself to people who spend too much time with the dead. So do we need to be a little bit more careful about how we might be exoticizing the other, I guess, you know, the way different kind of rituals or different customs? And there have been problems around the world with, say, sky burial in Tibet. This is where they lay the bodies out at the top of mountains, and the vultures feed on them, a hugely important religious ceremony. But it's a tourist destination now, and it's become very problematic in all kinds of ways. So, you know, we need to explore these things, I think, with a sense of what is it that we're really attracted by here.
I want to talk about, in turn, each one of the three major sections of the book that you have, and I'm going to start with the origins of burial. What's the earliest prehistoric remains that we know of that may indicate a burial practice or a burial process?
So that's a really good question, and it's a really difficult question, because anyone who follows the news, you know, you might hear that just this week or just last week they found another set of remains that pushed the timeline back. And it used to be the case that we thought that what defines Homo sapiens is this, what archaeologists call intentional deposition. That is, you deliberately decided to deposit a body somewhere. And increasingly, I think people are recognizing that hominids, that is, you know, versions of whether the Homo sapiens are descended from, they were also kind of conducting those kinds of rituals as well, probably. But the material is really difficult to interpret. And of course, the older it is, if it's millions of years back, all you've often got are very, very fragmentary remains. And it tells us something about ourselves, I think, of what we're projecting onto those remains all the time. So a really good example of that is in the 1950s, there was a discovery of a Neanderthal burial, and this had seemingly lots of different kinds of pollen associated with it. And this was a new kind of scientific method that had just been emerging. And they got very excited because they just thought, oh, great, this means that they buried them with flowers. This is clearly, what a lovely bunch of people. And it's only later in our era that we've discovered that probably that came from the excretion of the rats that ate the bodies. So that kind of sense of, you know, our shift of attitude towards these things is kind of constant. So it's very difficult to answer that question. And I think it says quite a lot about how we want to think of humans as being distinct species in what they do with their beloved dead. But it gets harder and harder to claim that, I think.
I'm only going to be able to sample little parts of this book because it covers so much time. I want to let the audience know that you really need to pick up this book. Plus the fact it's a beautiful book. It's profoundly illustrated. It's deeply illustrated. You write that early on, skulls become cult objects, and this is associated with worship of the dead. And, you know, it even goes down through Christian, where they have these ossuaries, and walls can be constructed of skulls, too. And the skull seems like the obvious, if you're going to worship a part of the body that's dead, it seemed like the skull would be the way to go.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's the skull is still a very expressive object, isn't it?
It is.
You can kind of, you know, it mirrors you back in a way. So I think, you know, seeing some of the earliest examples of collections of burial objects are often skull collections or patternings of skulls, or even, you know, putting decorative strips across skulls, which suggest that they were probably used posthumously. But it's clearly a kind of measure of ourselves to stare back at a skull, and that's why it's always the center of those paintings, those memento mori paintings, you know, because it allows you to reflect on, you know, the skull beneath the skin, I guess, and to think on your own mortality.
Now, you cover, obviously, the Egyptian culture, which we can't even get into. That would be like five interviews just covering what you wrote about that. But the thing I love about this book is not only do you cover the major topics, but you make digressions into all sorts of interesting things. And we're talking about Egyptian mummies, and you write a lot about them. Talk to me about Egyptian brown.
Oh, yeah, great. Well, so yes, I think everyone knows the whole kind of process of mummification. I think we're all taught it at school still. So in that sense, you know, everyone sort of knows the rough outline of that. And I think kids love the kind of gruesomeness of that. But there is something truly bizarre about how we have used mummies in the West. So, you know, in the Renaissance period, it was a very valuable medicine. You rub it on yourself to kind of prevent bruises and all that sort of stuff. And then it was used as a pigment as well. So it got mixed into paint, and lots and lots of Victorian paintings used a color, which is called mummy brown. And I think it was Holman Hunt, the Pre-Raphaelite painter, who was absolutely horrified to discover that he was basically daubing on bits of body onto his paintings. And so kind of, you know, a hugely sensitive, foppish painter who conducted a funeral ceremony over a tube of paint in his back garden once he realized this. But the thing that really astounded me was that this only stopped in the 1960s.
So I think
you can still get mummy brown, which had actual mummy in it in the 1960s, which I find phenomenal.
Amazing. At what point do cemeteries become common? Now, that's different from just ceremoniously tending the body after it's when it's dead, but cemeteries where there are congregations of bodies. Where does that start?
Yeah, again, it's a difficult question sometimes to answer. But I think, you know, there are cultures that begin to recognize, you know, once you settle in cities or in towns, you have a problem with how you manage the dead, because, of course, you need to separate the living from the dead for health reasons and religious reasons and so on. So quite early on, you would get the idea of the, if you have a metropolis, you have a parallel necropolis, that place for the dead, the city of the dead. And I think, you know, the Assyrians did that, but also the Greeks. But it's the Romans who begin to kind of formulate laws about where you can bury people. And they were following Etruscan civilization that had very elaborate necropolises. You know, they built houses for their dead, and they kind of put them to one side with their own shadow city next to your own city. It's quite amazing. But it's the Romans who say you must not bury inside the city walls. And that's why, I mean, I live in London, which famously has seven gates, or used to, around the city. So immediately beyond those gates, everything is saturated in the dead, essentially. So they keep digging stuff up all the time, because as soon as you get beyond the bounds of the living city, you're in the place of the dead city. And then you can start to specify that a little bit more and say, well, we need perhaps to designate certain places. And that's where you begin to get the idea of the cemetery.
Now, there's a tradition in Christian belief of burying in churchyards. Can you just elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So this is very, very different from Roman custom. And it's partly why the Romans were a little bit uncertain about this emerging cult happening in their empire. And it's because there's a wholly different relationship to the dead, I think, with Christianity. And of course, it's focused on the body of the Messiah, in a sense, and, you know, the bodily resurrection, and this kind of key ideas around the preserving and respect for the dead. You need to be buried whole in order to be resurrected physically whole. So that kind of idea of needing to be buried was really crucial. And you also started to get this idea of, well, it's good if you're near a sacred place or designated sacred place. And that can be, you know, if you're very important, under the altar of a Christian church, or in the crypt, or in the walls of Christian church, but then also in the churchyard around it. So this idea of designating consecrated ground, which would be near to the altar and near to salvation, in effect, that was very important for Christian culture and very, very different from what had come before.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Roger Luckhurst. He's a professor of 19th century studies at Birkbeck College, University of London. We're talking about his new book. It is really an amazing book, Graveyards, A History of Living with the Dead. One of the things that a section I found particularly interesting, because I've been fascinated by this by a long time, is the era of body snatching.
Sure.
And that, it was not a long time when you look at things historically, but it really affected cultures, especially in places like Britain and Europe, where people feared what was happening.
Yeah, this is a very specific kind of problem that emerges. I think everyone knows the story of the body snatchers in Edinburgh. And why is that happening? Why did it happen in the late 18th century? Well, it's partly a problem of the emergence of science and particularly of medicine. So we all know that medics are trained by a process of dissecting a dead body, beginning to understand the whole kind of systems of the body. But this, of course, was profound sacrilege if you have a dominant Christian culture. And it was only until the middle of the 18th century that there began to be released to some of these medical schools bodies for dissection. Because before that, only six or seven a year had been allowed by the government, because this was, of course, sacrilege. So these were the worst kind of criminals, the murderers who were already damned, and you could do whatever you like with their body. Now, as you get more and more people being interested in training as a medic, you get a problem of supply and demand. And what happens with the body snatchers is that they say, okay, so we can start to provide bodies by taking recent burials from the graveyard. And in some famous cases, just cutting out that whole process is quite exhausting, snatching bodies, and just like straightforwardly kill people and then just take them around the corner to your nearest medical school. So that was a kind of real crisis, and that started in the 1770s, and it continued certainly in the UK until 1832, very precise moment, when there was a new Anatomy Act, which allowed for more bodies to be released, but they're still pauper bodies, bodies that families can't afford to bury or have just been abandoned. And so there's still a great amount of shame and a real sense of, you know, religious dread that that's happening. So there's an economics to this as well that kind of shifts. Our attitude now, I think, is completely different to that, although some people still feel very queasy about medical donation. Many people now see that as one favorable way of continuing your life after death by making your body useful to the living.
One of the things that was happening at that time, as I read about in your book, are public dissections. And you illustrated it with a absolute wonderful print by William Hogarth, The Reward of Cruelty, which is, first of all, is worth the price of admission alone, just to see that print. But, I mean, that's a real thing. I mean, who wants their body after they're dead to be, like, entertainment for the masses?
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't know if you know the story of Jeremy Bentham, but
It is the photographs in the book, right?
Yeah, yeah. Because he's a really key kind of reformer and, you know, kind of a very modern thinker. And he was the founder of a philosophy called utilitarianism. So in other words, utility, use, everything must have a use. And he said that even the dead body must have a use. So in order to demonstrate this, he gave up his body to medical science. It was publicly dissected by a friend of his. And then even better, was preserved and put in a box in University College London. And it is still there. It's in the square where I work.
They had to do some touch-up recently, didn't they?
Yeah, they did, yeah, because there was, you know, he's stuffed with straw and kind of preserved in a very kind of weird way. This was 1832, so, you know.
Well, he's fully dressed. I think he has his cane. And he's got his hat on. Does he have a hat on?
No. Yeah. Oh, yes, he has a hat. Yeah, but his head is unfortunately waxed. But that's largely because King's College students, which is about a mile down the road, kept stealing his head, and there would be a whole kind of competition about who had the head. And for a while, the University College Senate could only sit if the head was present, you know, so that would kind of confirm that they were quorate by having Jeremy Bentham's head. So it's all of these wonderful kind of eccentric details that that I think people love about kind of burial history. They're sort of gruesome, they're comic, but they also tell you a lot of things about a particular moment in time
or
in culture.
How did and you write about this? How the various plagues that swept across Europe, how did that affect burial practices?
Yeah, so there are, you know, periodically, and we've had this very recently, actually, with COVID, where there was a crisis of burial as well in some American states. And I remember reading the New York Times about, you know, having to open a whole series of graveyards to kind of cope with the numbers. So that's a historic kind of issue. In Europe in 1348, 40% of the European population was killed by the Black Plague. And that is thought to have helped foster this whole kind of rise of monasteries and convents that would pray specifically for the dead, for the kind of numberless dead. And again, you know, I live very near a couple of grave pits because I'm just outside the walls of the City of London. So therefore, where I live is saturated with this kind of dead. And I grew up, perhaps this tells you why I'm obsessed with this. I grew up in my childhood with these stories of the City of London, new tower blocks being built, and they'd have to stop the whole process because they'd found another grave pit, and it was full of plague victims. So this was a real kind of medical concern. And you got these kinds of massive pits of kind of the anonymous dead that were set all the way around the city at that time. So kind of how they dealt with it was emergency needs must, really.
One of the things you write about, is the rise of the garden cemetery. We have one right here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Mount Auburn. A place I birdwatch a lot. Yeah, and these cemeteries become a different kind of thing. They become, today at least they are, they're like a park. They're a park where people don't just visit to visit a grave, but go to walk, go to run their dog, birdwatch like a lot of people do. What spurred that? That's a whole different treatment of the burial.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And that's very distinctly datable to if people have been to Paris, they might have been to Père Lachaise, which is an amazingly romantic garden graveyard. And it was really one of the first and became hugely influential around the world, including, you know, very obvious tract in Mount Auburn as well. So in 1802, they opened this Père Lachaise cemetery because of a very gruesome detail that happened in the 1780s, which was like other Christian capital cities, churchyards were the only consecrated places where people could be buried. They were very, very overstuffed with bodies. And a particular period of torrential rain, which just kept going and going and going, caused quite a lot of these inner-city graveyards to simply burst. I mean, they burst open, and the dead were washed straight away through the city. And that caused a real crisis of kind of, you know, hygiene and health concerns and so on in Paris. And then it's the revolution that kind of pushes towards a more secular idea that perhaps you need to have these dedicated spaces where you can begin to merge the natural world with graves and graveyards,
right,
and allow a kind of different sort of spirit to kind of emerge. So they're non partisan, you know, they're not necessarily tied to any sect. And that sort of openness is a brand new idea, as well as an appeal to nature. Of course, this is the Romantic period, so this idea of sublime nature is something that's very important. So, yeah, you see Père Lachaise have a huge influence around the world. And in London, there are the so-called Magnificent Seven,
right,
which are these seven giant garden cemeteries that surround the city. And they were all built in the 1820s and 1830s. And, you know, you see what, there's a beautiful one in Glasgow, there's one in Liverpool. And then it goes across to America. And, of course, you know, the Transcendentalist movement and the Romantic movement there were very strongly kind of leaning towards that idea as well. So, you know, the new American Republic would be open and democratic even in death.
We're almost out of time, but I want to mention your afterword chapter I thought was really important to read. It's all about the contemporary thoughts about dealing with the dead. And you talk about cremation, which has been around for a while, but it's now starting to become the preferred way of dealing with the body. There are natural burials where you just put the body in the ground with no thing to preserve it. Mm-hmm. There are body farms where, and there's even people trying to dodge the whole thing by doing cryogenic body preservation. Are we losing something, our relationship with the dead?
It's a really good question. I think the thing that I learned was that there's no kind of obvious through line, really. There's no kind of natural development. We don't really know why, for example, the Romans were so passionately attached to cremation and burning on pyres, and then suddenly turning to burial. It doesn't sort of make, it's not quite clear why that happened. And it's the same constantly, is you have these sudden kind of veers of custom and perhaps also of taste. So that in the UK, I mean, you couldn't cremate bodies until 1880s. It was illegal. In fact, people were prosecuted for trying to put bodies on pyres. And then suddenly it was legal, and it might be trendy and modern, but people get more and more find it more and more acceptable until it's now, as you say, the predominant thing. I always worry about people saying, of course, even graveyards are going to the dogs now. It's awful. But we are definitely in a period of multiplication of possibilities. So, you know, yes, natural burial seems to be very kind of common, but that's only been around really since the 1990s.
And there's still a lot of laws locally about natural burial.
Absolutely, yeah. Really, really kind of careful circumspection around that. But, you know, these new things like being able to crush remains down into diamonds so you can wear your loved one if you really want. Or you can fire your loved one into space if Elon Musk has some room on a satellite. And, you know, there are whole kind of gradations of that as well. So you can go into low Earth orbit, quite cheap. You can be fired into the moon. So I guess you look up every time you see the moon, you see your loved one. Or you can go into deep space, if you like, along with the rest of the Star Trek crew. So that kind of those sort of ideas are really wonderful. I mean, my favorite detail I think about nearly every day is the founder of cryogenics. So this is, you know, preserving, freezing bodies at a very, very low temperature so that we can eventually find a solution to death. So Robert Ettinger, who founded that whole movement, wrote a book called The Prospect for Immortality. So his head is preserved in his installation, but so are both of his wives. And what happens when we solve the problem of death? Who's he going to hang out with? This is going to be a huge problem, isn't it, for Robert Ettinger?
This is an amazing book. My guest tonight is Roger Luckhurst. He's a professor of 19th century studies at Birkbeck University of London, Birkbeck College, University of London. And we've been talking about his recent book, and we've literally just dipped into it briefly. Graveyards, A History of Living with the Dead. Roger, it's been a real pleasure.
Oh, that was fantastic. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about the book.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.